Hello and welcome to the PlanetIRL.com podcast. This week I'm joined by my regular co-commentator Paul Dalby and a special guest analyst this week, Kurt Cavan from IndyStar and Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee. How are you guys this evening?
Good.
I'm excellent.
Good. So first off on the agenda, over the last couple of weeks, there have been cuts throughout the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and I wanted to get your take on that. I think we'll start with Kurt here. What are the short-term effects, and what are the long-term hurting things that will happen from these cuts?
Well, a little background. The Speedway started about a year ago with about 400, a little north of 400 people. They lost the motel staff of about 20. And by the way, that staff of 400 includes the golf course, it includes the motel, it includes the food and beverage service, it includes IMS production, it does not include the Indy Racing League, and the administration itself and facilities, of course. So a staff of somewhere between 350 and 400, maybe even as high as 410, 420, that staff lost 20 people last December, it lost another 25 throughout the company last week, and so it represents about a 10% decline, maybe 12%. I don't know the exact number on how many people were there, so that changes the number a little bit. And losing a 10% to 12% part of the staff, I would first say, is pretty consistent with what we've seen at other companies, in fact, during this economic downturn. Short term, what it means, obviously, is bad publicity. It means stress for not only the people who have been released at the Speedway, it puts a strain on those who remain. Obviously, jobs are being realigned. This is a new leadership, remember, than just Tony George. So there is unrest from people who are not sure, perhaps what the expectations are from the new boss. I mean, this is consistent with everything you see in other companies. Pretty high profile. The other difference with this company is that it's privately owned, so a lot of the details don't come to light in the traditional manner. You start finding out about people and losses in a different way than what we maybe see in other situations. This is very high profile, so it's talked about on the blogs and on the internet and in radio shows and so forth, and so it becomes, you start to question, really, is something wrong with the company? And while that might be true in some cases, again, I don't think it's a whole lot different than what I've seen, for example, at the Indianapolis Star and what a lot of businesses in this economic environment have experienced. So short term, a lot of pain, a lot of questions. Long term, probably not a great deal of difference. There's certainly some tightening of the belt there, and there may be more. I'm not sure that we have enough time, if enough time has gone by yet, to know what the long-term effects are.
And Paul, what's your take on all the cuts? Do you have anything else to add?
Well, at this point, the cuts that we've heard about, I think obviously it's painful for the people that have been let go. But from a PR standpoint, you look at two of the ones that were released this week. I think of Gloria Novotny, who I was told had been there either 36 or 37 years at the track, which, you know, obviously goes back to the days of Tony Holman being there. And one of the things I've always heard about Tony was that he had such great relationships with all of the people that worked for and with him. And it sort of seems now that going from that sort of the mom-and-pop feel that the Speedway always had, you know, that kind of collective, it's all of ours, not just the Holman-George families, you know, that's starting to, or is well on the way of kind of being abolished now, and it really feels more like it's become the big corporate USA-type track. Almost feels like it's starting to sterilize itself and become an ISC-esque track. The other one that I think really hurts from a PR standpoint was Chase Eaton being let go. Chase was the liaison between the league and the downforce. the Downforce fan club. And when you isolate the fan club and take away their liaison, even though he's been replaced by Jason Penix, who I understand is very capable and will do a fine job, but when you take away that liaison between the fans and the league, it makes your fan base feel isolated. And I think we're going to need a little bit of time to see how Downforce reacts to that and how the Downforce fans really take the news that the person that they've used as their, you know, voice toward the league has been let go. I know I personally had dealt with Chase on a handful of occasions, and he was very, very friendly to me. He always treated me and anyone else that I saw interact with him very well. And I'm sure the same could be said for all the employees at IMS who unfortunately have been let go in these times.
I actually, I'd like to weigh in here on both those areas that you went down. Certainly, it's disappointing for Chase, and you have a real sympathy. I can't give empathy because I've not been fired. I've not been released from a job. I've had this one at the Star my entire career. So certainly, I have, you know, that feeling and sympathy. But I don't think this signifies that the position has changed, or that the intent of the company isn't to relate to not only the fans but the media, because the media director was among those, Ron Green, among those as well. So I don't think that signals a change in philosophy so much as they make decisions. People change in these positions all the time, and so I can't imagine a scenario that the Speedway doesn't have an interest in servicing the media or its fan base, because those two groups are two of the lifebloods of the facility and of the Indy Racing League. The other thing is that there's been some good and some bad to operating like a mom and pop. And first of all, this is still very much a mom and pop organization. Let's be very clear about that. ISC has 13 tracks, and it shuffles people between tracks regularly. And people move from Kansas to California to Richmond and really have no base. This track, almost to a fault, has kept people. Part of it was, you know, it grew out of luxury in some respects. And there are probably some things that needed to be changed. I know the Indianapolis Star functioned very similarly for a long time. It was a family-owned business that had some people that probably should have gone long ago. And when we were taken corporate, which this one has not, by the way, the Speedway has not been taken to an ISC level. It may at one point, but it's not there at this point. There were some good things that happened too. So I think we just, as a journalist, I'd like to keep an open mind that there could be some positives as well as the personal negatives that we see initially.
Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that you both said that's really good is it is a mom and pop place. When you go to the track, you feel at home, and everyone there is friendly. And I know people that have worked there for, you know, as yellow shirts or whatnot for 40 or 50 years. So it did hurt that these people are let go. But as Kurt said, I think it's still going to be IMS, and it's still going to be a very close-knit sort of community feel. And, Paul, I saw that you put down here on things to talk about that Jeff Belskis, maybe is he the one in charge of this, or is he the one that is making it so corporate? What are your thoughts on him, Paul?
Well, obviously, coming from the accounting side, he previously was the chief financial officer before he got elevated by the board. He's looking at the overall situation from an accounting standpoint, and you know that's what in the end of the day, that's what he was brought in to do, is to look at the bottom line and make sure that the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Corporation as a whole was a profitable entity. And you know, from an accounting standpoint, it seems he's making those changes to make sure that the outgoing costs are reduced. At the same time, though, You know, it's my feeling is that, you know, in these tough economic times, you know, the businesses that thrive coming out of these are the ones that really continue to market and to be proactive and aggressive during this time. And to me, again, from an outsider standpoint, it seems that his fiscal conservatism in these times are really going counter to the aggressive marketing that you would see out of an Eddie Gossage or a Humpy Wheeler. Those type of individuals who really push and you know, come up with innovative ways to get their word to the people and promote their business. I'm sure Texas Motor Speedway and SMI and ISC and all the other tracks have had to make cuts and you know, are feeling the pinch as well. But I don't get the same sense, and Kurt pointed this out earlier, obviously Jeff has only been in the position about 4 months now, but I don't see that sense of active public engaging or promotion from the face of the Speedway, and really that's what Jeff is now, is he's the face of the Speedway. I don't see that same approach coming from him that I would see from an Eddie Gossage or, you know, somebody in that position. And that's where I think Jeff is really lacking to this point, is he has not come out and engaged the public yet. He hasn't. In fact, I don't know that he's had any public interaction except for the IZOD press conference. I think that was probably the first time most of us had ever seen his face.
Well, let's remember that his first press conference actually came with Joey Chitwood when he was introduced, and it didn't show very well for Jeff, because not that Jeff probably didn't do an okay job in the situation, actually he did not, and by his own admission it wasn't a very good presentation on his part, but Joey's strength is in communication, and that showed dramatically when you sat them side by side. Remember that we're almost talking about two separate things here. Jeff Belskis is in the position that he's in because Tony George, in the opinion of the board, not anyone else's opinion, but in the opinion of the board of directors, was not leading the company in the direction that the board of directors set forth. We can argue that, we can debate that, but that's the decision made by the board of directors. But what you're really talking about here is Jeff replacing Joey Chitwood. He's been asked, and I'm not going to defend his public leadership just yet, because again, it's only been 3.5-4 months, so I don't know that we quite know where he's going, and he hasn't come out yet and outlined these things. But what so far we've established is that he's trying to replace Joey Chitwood and Tony George. And he's trying to clean up a financial situation where I don't know that you're willing to say that they're losing money, but clearly revenue is down and costs are up. So it isn't that the bottom line is in a precarious position. It may be. We don't know that. As a private company, we don't know that. But he is charged with making the company more efficient. And right now, those are three separate jobs that he's doing. Tony's, Joey's, and making sense of things from a financial officer standpoint. So he's taken on a lot. So I think from my standpoint at this point, I think he's going to have to get a little more slack, although he doesn't have a whole lot of time to, as they say, there's not a lot of opportunities to make a first impression, and he needs to get on that pretty quickly.
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. I think that he's probably bitten off more than he can chew at this point. You know, Joey Chitwood
mind
promoted.
You,
I think
mind
Joey
you,
Chitwood
didn't bite off.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, mind you, he didn't decide to bite off more than he can chew. This is what was handed to him.
Very true, that's very true. I think whoever it was, whether it's his decision or the board's decision, to not hire a separate person to be the president of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and merge that job with the CEO of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Corporation, either one of those, I'm sure, is a full-time job. I don't know that Tony George or Joey Chitwood really, you know, kick their feet up on their desk all that often. And you try to put both of those jobs in one person's hands, you know, you suffer, I think, in both positions. So I think, as in my opinion, as long as he has to fulfill both of those jobs, I don't know that he'll excel in either one of them.
And I think what they do need is someone behind the scenes like Jeff Belzkus. Maybe he's a good leader, as in making decisions, and then they need to get someone, like I know Kurt said, like a John Andretti, maybe not him, maybe someone else, but someone that is a front person. They need two different people to lead this, at least.
You need somebody that can engage the public, that the public, not trust or wants to see, but the public is at least comfortable with, and you need that person to have charisma. You know, somebody who is engaging with the fans, and I don't see Jeff being that person.
What's interesting is that had you had this conversation prior to Joey Chitwood's arrival, you wouldn't have said that Jeff Belzkus was less of this than Tony George was. But Joey Chitwood kind of changed things by being dynamic enough. Not so much with the fans, and I don't know how it's always perceived on the outside, but I'll tell you where Joey Chitwood excelled, and that's with the Convention Bureau, with the 500 Festival, all of these entities that support the community, or from the community that support the Speedway, and the race, and the league, he was excellent at. He could press palms with anyone, and not in a negative way. I mean, sometimes, I know Eddie Gossage gets this negativity based off his showmanship, but both those individuals know how to press the right palms at the right time.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So moving on from IMS, more into the IndyCar series as a whole, I know, Paul, you wanted to talk about the new chassis and engine formulas, and I know all of the listeners have heard us talk about that endlessly, so I'm going to throw this to Kurt first. What are your ideas, Kurt, for a new chassis? And do you want multiple? And if so, do you want multiple engines and chassis? What are your thoughts on that as a whole?
I think I'm not as worried about the multiple chassis. I don't think that any of us are going to go out and buy a Lola versus a Renard versus, you know, a Dallara. That doesn't drive me, actually, as much as somebody looking at what's best for this series. Maybe, because I'm assuming here, for example, that for a moment, that we're not talking about dramatically different cars. I mean, in NASCAR, the Fords and the Chevys, and I can't tell the difference, and I go to these races even before they went with the Car of Tomorrow. Truthfully, if I stood there and looked at them, I'd have to look pretty hard to know the true differences between the cars, and the multiple chassis thing just doesn't mean as much to me, although I understand why it does to other people. But I do think the multiple engines platform is important for a lot of different reasons, primarily because of marketing capabilities, and I think competition between Honda and Ford and General Motors or Fiat, name your car company, from a badging standpoint. I think that is excellent for the series. If we were going back to the days of truly building your own cars, and we had multiple different types of cars on the track, I think then I would be more in favor of a very open chassis situation. But the reality that exists kind of prohibits me from making a big stand about chassis. I just don't think that's going to be in the future of the sport. I don't see it turning into Formula One where everybody's cars look different every year. Ideally, that would be great. I just don't see that happening in today's economic climate. I don't see enough return for the manufacturers from IndyCar racing.
Well, I hear your point about the engines, but really, if you look back to 2003 through 5, we had Toyota, Honda, and Chevy all in the series at that time. They were kind of marketing, I suppose. They were at least putting their obligatory ad in USA Today or Sports Illustrated after each week or wherever it was. But really, if you look back, those were maybe the lowest point of the IRL, certainly within this decade, when they had those manufacturers who were spending the marketing dollars, but they still weren't reaching the fans. So from a marketing standpoint, you know, I see where the gain is, but I don't know that what we've seen over the past 10 years has really, really justified that or support that theory, at least from what I see. What I worry about with the multiple manufacturers is that if you have more than one, you're guaranteed to have one that's superior to the others. And we saw that in 2005 when Penske and Ganassi held on to the Toyota. And if you have somebody like a Scott Dixon, I think Sam Hornish was with Penske then, and Alio, if those three can't make up the difference between a Toyota and a Honda, I mean, there's nobody that's going to. And when you have the field as separated as it was that year, you know, it just really makes an uneven playing field that I don't know that a lot of fans, you know, they say they want the multiple manufacturers, but then when you see technology or performance that's as different as they were that year, there were a lot of complaints that year about having the Toyota and how down it was and how the races weren't even fair, that, you know, Andretti Green that year with their super team just drove away, and Dan Weldon had a heck of a year that year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting, and some people, this is not a divisive subject, but it's one where people are clearly on one side or the other, and some people would like this to be a series as it was in the 60s and the 70s, where any car, even before that, the cars were different, and that drove interest. And there are other people that think that close racing is what's important, and the manufacturers, you know, are irrelevant to the discussion. You know, I guess I'm somewhere in between. And from a personal standpoint, my interest in the sport lies with the drivers, and I would like the cars not to be the reason why a driver can't succeed.
I respect
those who find great interest in the equipment too. So, you know, this is a car sport, and there are a lot of people who are quote unquote car people, and they love that aspect of it. They love the technology, and we would not be as a consumer group, we would not be better served had auto racing and IndyCar racing to a large degree not developed products over the years and developed safety aspects over the years. So development is good, and teams taking chances on items is good. But I'm at the point where I'm more interested at this point in my life. I'm 45 years old. I'm more interested in learning the personalities and watching the drivers. But that's just me, and I'm open to wherever this thing ends up.
I agree. I think I'm somewhere in the middle with you. I see the merits of both a closed rule book spec series just as much as I see the merits of a very open multiple manufacturer, multiple chassis situation, which kind of leads me to my next point. When we were talking about, you know, different cars and what we want the next 2012 spec to look like, one of the things I found interesting is over the, you know, last several years, you've heard so many fans say they want to see the drivers drive the cars more. They want to see, you know, the teams have a chance to make adjustments on the car, but they want to see the drivers have to use a little brake input when they go into the corners. Seems about the exact same people that always said that complained after the Homestead race that some teams had hit it, some teams didn't hit the setup, and you had three guys walk away with it. It's just the grass is always greener, and, you know, they always want what they don't have, but then when they get a taste of it, it seems that they were very disappointed. And we heard more complaints after the Homestead race where the three leaders walked away than we did after the Chicago race where we saw the more traditional IndyCar pack racing, don't you think?
Well, I don't really want to get in the middle of it because I see both sides to it. Personally, as I said on the show, on my radio show, I enjoyed Homestead because I enjoyed the competition at the front. Those three guys were going for the championship, and they really went for it. And You know, I don't know if it was a function of the multiple variations that were available to the teams after Kentucky, but it's pretty clear that at Homestead, some people got it and some people didn't. And those that did it, that got it, shouldn't surprise you. They're the best in the business, and they will get it most of the time. I mean, it's going to be Penske and Ganassi next year. Now, there may be some other teams rise to their level, but those two will not stoop to the other's level. I mean, if a Newman Haas is going to be competitive with them, or AGR, they're going to have to rise to Ganassi and Penske's level. This is not an accident that Penske wins the Indy 500. They do it every year, no matter what the rules are, no matter how many chassis there are, no matter how many engine manufacturers there are. They are a good team with good people. They hire the right staffs, and they know what they're doing, and they're going to succeed most of the time.
And in 2012, if there's a new chassis, we may see a year or two, maybe even, of parity. But I guarantee you within 3 or 4 years, you're going to see the Penske's and the Ganassi's and probably the Newman Haas again. You're going to see them, those three teams, right back to the top because, like you said, they have the best people. They have the best technology. They have the best resources. They're the best teams. They're going to rise to the top, and there's really no way to change that other than come up with a whole new set of specs pretty much every other year.
This is no different than baseball, for example. The Yankees and the Red Sox, because they've got more money to spend on more internal people, even more their depths are better. They can buy the right people from the Devil Rays and the Reds, and they can buy the right people for engineering and so forth. You know, that's okay to have a Yankees. It really is. It's because without a Yankees, you don't have a goal to shoot for. Without a Penske, I mean, if Penske were to leave this series, just for example, let's say take Penske and Ganassi out of the mix, what do you have that you've won? And that's kind of what people said about the IRL in its first 96, 97, 98, 99, 2000. Well, that's what they were saying. Yeah, but who did you beat? Well, when you beat a Ganassi or a Penske, you've done something, and that's so it's good to have good teams up front. That's when you've beat them, you've done something.
And I think the thing that I see out of it is, and going back to kind of throwing the engine in the chassis, because I didn't get a spot there, was the you have two options. You can go back to the 60s style car, and you can design a whole series around trying to recreate that, and the guys building their cars out of their sheds and please those people. Or you can do the more NASCAR style where it's more spec. And I think as hardcore fans like the three of us are, we'd like to maybe see a little more of the older style. But if we're going to draw in new fans, we are going to need to pull in the new... We're not going to pull in new people with old technology and stuff because, honestly, people just don't seem interested. Maybe the fans we already have are interested in seeing a turbine car, but Joe Schmo that's flipping to the channels just wants to see three wide at Chicago. So we need to direct the series to a new audience instead of just trying to please the one we have.
Yep.
Yeah, I've said it before that the growth of the IndyCar series isn't going to come from stealing NASCAR. You've got to be able to reach out and reach the people that are not race fans right now.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever they do with the cars and the engines, that needs to be the goal, is reaching out to those people that aren't currently watching a race on Sunday afternoons now.
Well, let me say that just based off that, one thing I heard loud and clear from the blogger night that we had on our radio show last week is that there are two groups in play here. There are the fans, the people who are not fans yet, and there are the people who are already fans. The people who are already fans generally would like to see the multiple manufacturers, and they would like to see the kinds of things you're talking about. So you almost have to approach every decision or every path that you're going to pursue with two sets of people in mind, and some are going to benefit those already in the sport, which is a very important clientele because they're the ones buying the products, they're the loyal customers that you have. But sometimes it takes a different set of solutions and alternatives to please new fans or to attract new fans, and it's very difficult to do both. And as I listen to people who are trying to do both, it's a difficult proposition, and I don't envy them at all.
And you know, as you mentioned, the two groups of fans that need to be served to an IndyCar series, one of the other issues between those two very separate groups is whether USAC and other American oval, you know, bread and butter series need to be used instead of the European or Asian formulas. What are your takes on, is USAC relevant to the IndyCar series anymore?
Well, I think it is relevant. I don't know if it's as, well, it's certainly not as relevant as it was. I mean, there was obviously a period where, you know, they were almost joined at the hip. And they were, in fact, because board members such as Tony George were on both boards. There have been others. Ken Unger, for example, served on the USAC board while he worked at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So there has been a much stronger connection, and there continues to be a connection. Shoot, the offices are located literally within yards of each other, between the IRL, the Speedway, and the United States Auto Club on 16th Street. But, clearly, USAC drivers have a more clear path to NASCAR, and I've gone through this in many situations or in many forums to say that driving a USAC sprint car or a midget is more applicable to a stock car right now, the way the stock cars are set up as compared to Indy cars. Having said that, I still think there needs to be some hope for a USAC driver that he can get to IndyCar racing. I think Bobby East has kind of floated around the possibility of running the Indy 500 this year. He's a guy with some name value and some connections to the sport, lives just down the road from not only USAC but the Speedway. And so I think you can still see USAC drivers make it, but the reality is there are just more opportunities in NASCAR, and there is a more direct link from driving the car mechanically from one to the other, as opposed to sprint cars to Indy cars.
And you know, I saw, you know, over the last month or so, the USF 2000, and I mentioned this on Blogger Night, Kurt, the new series that the IRL will be sanctioning below Indy Lights. I think that, if they form it up right, can really be a new USAC, so to speak. It's low cost, and I really hope they do a lot of ovals and not just a bunch of road courses, because there are a lot of low-level Formula Ford-style open-wheel road racing series in America. We need to train drivers to get oval experience. There is no oval path to open-wheel racing anymore, and I think that's what they really need to focus on with USF 2000.
I would agree with that, and I think that will be a nice feeder to Indy Lights, theoretically, but we still haven't solved how you get drivers from Indy Lights to Indy cars, and you know that's still a big jump right now, and one that regardless of the level of jump, you're talking about only having between 22 and 26 seats available in IndyCars, and the reality is probably 18 of those are going to stay constant from one year to the next. At least, you know, one this year it may change 6 or 7 of those seats, but that's not a lot of change that open up a lot of room for the Hildebrands and so forth. But you know, you're going to have to. As I said the other day, I'm still surprised that more Indy Lights teams haven't made the jump to Indy cars. Not the drivers necessarily, but the teams. And once the teams make the jump, then the drivers will go in tow.
And the thing I thought about more after Blogger Night, after I mentioned the scholarship idea, was why not get Firestone involved? They've always been very good to the series. Have them have like a $2 million scholarship, say, for the winner of Indy Lights, and that person can use that $2 million sponsorship on an Indy car. So they bring money, and they get a year to try it out and show what they can do and do something like that.
I think that's a but certainly a great idea, and it's one that you could post towards Honda or any of your partners. The question is coming up with the budget to do so, because right now the budget that's coming, or the cash infusion that's coming from these partners, is being used in other ways. And right now I'm sure that Firestone Honda, they already have allotted the amount of money, they're already spending the amount of money they've allotted. And so just to add $2 million is not in the budget right now. And you know, we like to think that Firestone and Honda don't have the same economic concerns that every other company has at this point, but the reality is they do, and they have constraints just like all companies would.
Paul, do you have a take?
Well, going back to what you were talking about with USAC, you know, people keep talking, you know, there's no path to Indy for USAC now. I mean, let's be honest, USAC really hasn't been the path to Indy for pushing 30, 40 years now. I mean, you have to go back until, you know, the mid to late 60s before you start getting into a generation that came to Indy really from USAC. Once you got past the Unzers, Gordon Johncock, Johnny Rutherford, that whole genre of drivers, the next wave of drivers all came from Formula cars, really starting with, you probably go back as far as like a Mark Donahue, and then, you know, when you get through the 80s, the Bobby Rahals, the Danny Sullivans, you know, that whole genre of drivers, even all the way up through the Emerson Fittipaldis and the Nigel Mansells, obviously came from a road racing background. The USAC disconnect is not something that started with the IndyCar series. Granted, the IndyCar series was probably supposed to move it back there, but the fact is, and Kurt, you and Kevin have talked about this numerous times, these IndyCar teams are businesses. They're owned, you know, by owners who are going to go seek out the best talent that gets their car to win. And right now, and really for the last 30 years, that best talent has come from a road course pool. So it maybe instead of trying to figure out how you get the oval drivers from USAC to get the eyes of the IndyCar series, maybe USAC needs to adjust itself and offer some road racing availability or road racing series for their drivers to start making that transition from a midget and sprint background into the Formula Ford or to the Indy Pro Series. And I know last year there was some movement by Bruce Ashmore bringing on the new USAC Gold Crown car that was supposed to run some road courses, and I haven't heard anything on that, geez, probably in 6-8 months. So I don't know what if that's dead and gone or if they're still developing that. But I think you need to start with the younger, the dirt drivers and the midgets and sprint guys and get them some road racing experience, because really that's what the owners are looking for when they go, you know, pick the guys from Europe or Brazil. Because it has been proven many times, it's so much easier to take a road course driver and teach him how to do an oval than go vice versa. Trying to teach Ed Carpenter and Sarah Fisher how to road race has been much more of a challenge than it was to teach, you know, Tony Kanaan or Dan Weldon or all the other foreign drivers we have now, trying to teach them how to oval race.
Remember one thing here that's in play, and that the United States Auto Club is a business just like all the other businesses we've discussed today. The United States Auto Club, the best way it can attract drivers to its series, because it is in a tight crunch itself. It's trying to get better drivers, better car owners, better sponsors to its series. And the best way that it finds that it can attract people is to show that there is a direct link between USAC and what? NASCAR. Because that's the word that gets people's attention when you're a Casey Kane out in the state of Washington and you see and you're being told that these cars will help prepare you for NASCAR. I mean, Casey's not the right example, but I picked him out because he was far away from the Midwest. But you're drawing people to the Midwest to run USAC because they're telling you, look, they can throw that word NASCAR in there and people sit up and notice. because then they've got a track record. Not only do drivers who come from USAC right now succeed in stock cars, or not only are they getting there, they're succeeding. So USAC isn't exactly, I'm not saying they're not interested in producing road racers for the IndyCar series, but they see, as they should, that the smart way to help their business is to utilize the assets at hand, and those assets for the moment are rides in NASCAR.
I know you both have to run here. So I think Paul had a couple questions prepared for Kurt that he wanted to throw out there, so we'll go over to Paul and let him explain what he's going to do here.
Well, I just figured everyone knows Kurt as the man behind the pen at the Star, and there's a lot of people said they don't really know Kurt, so we figured we'd come up with 12, a dozen quick questions for Kurt. Hopefully these are one-word answers. We'd like them to be one-word answers. Let's put it that way, so we'll just fire away here. So, starting at the top, Kurt, favorite all-time driver?
Rick Mears. That's two words.
We'll take that, because Rick's my favorite as well. He was at his peak when I came in to follow racing, and there's never been one better.
And I think that's what happens with everyone, is they associate or they grow to like somebody who was on top in their you know, years of really learning the sport. And as I grew up really with the sport in the late 70s, early 80s, Rick was the guy.
Yeah, I think he still is the guy. I think he could probably still show these guys a thing or two. All right. Best interview. Who do you enjoy interviewing most?
Well, I talk to Rick a lot. Among the current drivers, I'd have to say there are actually several. Guys like a Jill DeFerrin has been someone who's been very good for me to interview over the years because he's very insightful. He doesn't just give politically correct answers. He answers the questions and he explains things pretty well. So DeFerrin is one among the current. Brian Briscoe is very good at it as well.
Who's the worst person or the interview you look forward to least?
I would say Danica when she has her uniform on. When she is in street clothes, she's a terrific interview. But as I've said about her many times, and I think this is what the public struggles with, is that when she has her uniform on or her helmet on, she's so competitive that it's almost difficult to understand that spirit that she has. When she's out of uniform, very charismatic, very enjoyable, doesn't give the same answers twice. So it's almost two different people.
Okay. Other than Kurt Kevin, who's the best auto sports writer?
Writer or journal or reporter. Robin is a tremendous reporter. I spent 15 years working with him. His sources, his contact list is extraordinary. Writer is a different word. Robin's very creative. That's a tough one. I don't know that. I tend to be fans of writers who really aren't in racing. Phil Richards at the Star, for example, is a tremendous writer. Steve Ballard is a very good writer. Robin's a terrific reporter. And I think there's a difference. I don't think of myself as a good writer. Hopefully I'm a better reporter, because that's really what I love, is finding out the information and communicating it. Writing itself, the skill of writing is a different skill set.
All right, opposite of that, who's the most questionable writer? And I have a feeling we're probably not going to get an honest answer here.
It's us, Paul. It's us.
Well, no, you're not going to get an answer because that's not for me to answer, really. I think every story you have to look at and say, and this is the same as true of me, and I think people do this of me every time they read a story. Is the sourcing good? Is the source explained? Because sometimes, you know, people write things with no sourcing attached, or it's unclear where they got the information. When any of us have written good stories, we've learned information, we've sourced it well, and you can tell our objectives when you read the story.
You mentioned Robin Miller. Give me three words to describe Robin.
Energetic, opinionated, And the thing I don't think people realize about Robin is when he is your friend, he's almost a friend to a fault, and that's a good thing. That's a wonderful thing to have said about someone. His friends today are his friends, have been his friends really forever, and or since he met them, and he's really, believe it or not, people consider us kind of rivals at times. If I needed something tomorrow, no matter what it was, I could dial his phone number and know that he'd be there to help me with it, whether it be financial. He's helped so many people financially that it's almost beyond comprehension. It's certainly more than I've ever thought of helping people. So, yeah, you're not going to get a crossword from me on that subject.
All right. Three words to describe Shane Rogers.
I think his knowledge of I don't know if I can do it in three words, but his knowledge of the sport is incredible. For somebody who's lived that far away, his perspective is incredible. And his questioning is good too. As a reporter, I wish I had more of his ability to question things, not in a critical way, but just in a just of asking people tough questions.
Mm-hmm. The best burger on the IndyCar circuit.
You know, it's simple, but the In-N-Out burger still gets me. I'll still have two or three per trip, and I know it's not the pure classic burger, but that's pretty strong. And really, the best one, I'll say this, the best single cheeseburger is at the Working Man's Friend in Indianapolis. That's a little west of downtown, probably about a mile west of downtown, in a pretty dumpy part of town, really, but tremendous cheeseburger.
The Working Man's Burger?
The Working Man's Friend.
Working Man's Friend.
I've never had the In-N-Out Burger, but everyone talks about them, so I think that's definitely on my list.
Yep.
What's the best beer to go out to go with the Working Man's Burger?
I'm a pretty simple beer drinker. Is that what you asked, beer? I'm pretty much a Corona guy, so I don't deviate. And I don't have many. I might not have ten in the whole year, so it's not like I have many.
Oh, well, all right. Your favorite track still on the circuit, outside of Indy?
I suppose it would be Texas, just because of the total package. I like the mile and a half. I like the banking. I like the presentation of the facility. I would say it would have to be Texas for all of those reasons. I like Kansas and what they've done at Kansas. Kentucky's beautiful to go to, but I'd say that Texas is the one that brings the most things together.
The worst part of Kurt Cavan's job?
The reality is it's the writing. Because you spend so much time on the phone, you spend so much time gathering information. I'm doing an IU Indiana University basketball or football story right now, and I've got all these notes, and it's just taking what you have and sifting through it and then actually writing the story. I like editing the story, I like reporting the story, I like telling the story, but actually the part of writing is probably the most difficult part for me, and just because I want it to be perfect, and that's where the finished product comes into play, and you want it to be perfect, and you know that's the last thing everybody, that's the one thing everybody sees. You could do all the reporting, but if you don't do a good job with the writing, that it's kind of, I wouldn't say it's lost, but all your work is more under scrutiny as a writer, and so there's probably more pressure there, and that's probably the part that I struggle with. I like the travel, I like the deadlines. I like the weekends even, but the writing sometimes is...
Don't scare me away from it now, Kurt.
Well, no, I love my profession. It's just, I mean, the physical act of the writing it.
And the final question, of all the races you've been out to, which one all time sticks out most in your mind or is your favorite that you've ever been to?
2002, I'm excluding Indy because Indy's usually delivers the magical moment in every season, even if it's not the greatest race. But I would say the 2002 IndyCar race at Michigan was breathtaking. We ran but the IndyCar series probably had 8 or 10 drivers just in a great pack through most of the race, and Sarah Fisher was in the mix, Thomas Schechter was in the mix, Eddie Cheever and Thomas Schechter had a week-long battle in the media. It was one of these races that had a lot of intrigue and drama and kind of fighting back and forth, and it just had a lot of storylines going, and then it was a tremendous race, too. One of the first couple races, or some of the early races at Texas, were tremendous, too. I remember one that went like 70 laps, where the first 16 cars were 2x2, nose to tail, for like 70 laps through a pit stop, and it was just a friend of mine who worked at the track, or actually he worked at Bristol, Bristol of all places, where it has tremendous racing, turns to me and says, because it had been so breathtaking for so many laps, he turned to me and he said, "This is unnecessary." And it truly was, your heart was pounding the whole way. But any of those early IndyCar races at Texas or the 2002 race at Michigan.
There you go, race fans. There's Kurt Kevin and 12 questions.
Okay. So
didn't seem like that many.
What's that?
It didn't seem like that many.
Well, we can come up with some more.
We can always get more.
Next time.
Okay, so I think that just about wraps it up. Do you guys have anything else you want to touch on?
No, the only thing that that I didn't have, and Kurt, if you can give us a one-word answer here, is Brazil actually going to happen?
I rated it as a 4 on a scale of 1 to 10, so I'm not as optimistic, but I'm going to say I'm leaning toward no.
I agree with you. I think it's too late at this point.
That's unfortunate completely, but I expected it too. So that just about wraps it up here. I want to thank Paul for joining me as usual, and a special thanks to Kurt for taking time out of his busy schedule to join us. And as always, be sure to read planetirl.com for all your news and opinion on everything IndyCar.